All right. Bible question. It's exciting. We're this assembly, you know, I remember when I think I was sweeping the floor with Luke when we were doing the expansion. And Luke was, you know, we'd been some bumps through part of that year. Luke was, I don't know about this expansion, but we're filling this place up. So, you know, and not that we want to fill the place up, but we want to fill the place up because it's souls. Okay, and equality souls. I see a lot of Bible studies going around. I know a lot of fresh faces that are in Bible studies. So I think we've got some visitors there. So, yeah, it's exciting. All right, the Bible question. According to the Bible, what are the two things that make up the foundation of God's throne? All right, over there, we got a new one. All right, which one?
Psalm 89:14.
Good job, Cody. It's exciting to see you again. Yeah, got you in Bible studies, looking at Bible questions. That's awesome. Psalm 89:14. I either looked it up wrong or I got a different answer. Oh, is there two? Okay. I thought there was only one. I didn't pick up. I didn't get this one. Good job, Cody. 89:14. Psalm 89. Come on. Wow, this phone is like a dog. Barely moving. 89:14. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Loving kindness and truth go before you. Nice. Very, very good. Nice, nice one. And it's going to actually be the same answer in the other place. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne. What's the other one? Will.
97:2.
That was the one I had. Cloud and thick darkness surround him. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne. Isn't that interesting, you know, that David wrote the book of Psalms, and, you know, here's two Psalms. I don't know, we have no idea how far apart these are written, but David, you know, it's consistent, you know, he wasn't making this stuff up. You know, it was prophetic. It was coming from God. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of God's throne. And I like that too. In the Old Testament, God shows that he's just. You know, you read the Old Testament and it's justice. Sin, sacrifice. Sin, penalty. But God is righteous as well. And he's proven that as well. And the exciting thing is we get Christ's righteousness, or we get the righteousness of God through Christ. You know, not a righteousness of our own, but we get his righteousness when we're clothed with Christ, when we're immersed into Christ. And so we can now actually be righteous and practice righteousness, which is what God... If that's his foundation, I mean, how's a black-hearted sinner going to be able to approach the throne of God in prayer, like John was bringing up? You know, the exciting thing about prayer is we get to go clean. It's exciting. So, like John was saying, take advantage of it. It was a really good opening. All right.
Good morning. You guys turn your Bible to the book of Acts. Acts chapter 7. Technology is amazing stuff, Mr. Miller, but there is something to be said for the old school paperbacks, too. I still liked it when Mike Donahue was doing that opening and somebody was texting him and trying to call him and he was using that for his phone. There's some... Yeah, anyways. You know, before we get into Acts chapter 7, I just got to say a couple things about that bulletin question. Wouldn't it be well if the rulers of this earth took notice of the ruler on the throne? If righteousness and justice were the foundation of these earthly thrones? Okay, wow. We are far from that, aren't we? And you have to be somebody who's intentionally sticking your head under the sand and keeping it there to not recognize the atrocities and abominations that are happening in this country. And all with the support and backing of the federal government.
That's right.
I'm actually probably going to work that in here a little bit in Acts chapter 7 today. But the Lord, righteousness and justice are the foundation of His throne. He's going to rule. You can have absolute confidence in Him that He's going to do what's right. And Larry brought it out. You know, it's interesting. The New Testament word just, many times it's translated. Let's turn to the book of Romans really quick. Romans chapter 3 ties in with what Larry was saying about the way that God has worked to bring us into to give us His righteousness and to bring us into a right standing with Him. In Romans chapter 3, let's just look at verse 21. It says, "But now apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. Even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all those who believe. For there is no distinction. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Being justified as a gift by His grace through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus, whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation in His blood through faith. This was to demonstrate His righteousness, because in the forbearance of God He passed over the sins previously committed, for the demonstration, I say, of His righteousness at the present time, that He might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus." I remember, I remember a guy many years ago saying justified means just as if I'd never sinned. And I remember Mr. Hopper always emphasizing that justified means being declared righteous. God is both just. There was a penalty that was to be paid for sin, wasn't there? He paid that price. He didn't set aside His justice. Jesus paid that price. That justice was met. But He also is the justifier, the one who declares us righteous in the process and makes us righteous. And so we do see both righteousness and justice coming together, and along with God's mercy and forgiveness. And I think one of those passages said something about loving kindness and truth, right? Go before Him. So the Lord brings all this together. What an awesome God, guys, that we serve. But let's remember His standard, His throne is established on righteousness and justice. All right, Acts chapter 7 is where we are for class. And we're going to pick it up today on the part that starts about Moses. So we just, a reminder here, Stephen on trial. And let's actually read the very end of chapter 6, verses 11 through 15, just to remind us. Then they secretly induced men to say, "We've heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and against God." And they stirred up the people, the elders, and the scribes, and they came upon him and dragged him away and brought him before the council. And they put forward false witnesses who said, "This man incessantly speaks against this holy place and the law. For we have heard him say that this Nazarene Jesus will destroy this place and alter the customs which Moses handed down to us." And fixing their gaze on him, all who were sitting in the council saw his face like the face of an angel. So this is the first time in the persecution of the church that actually the people get stirred up along with the Jewish authorities. Up till this point in time, you see the Jewish authorities were riled up a few times, but the people were holding the church in high esteem. Well, with some of these charges that were brought up, it got the people agitated. And I'm sure that there was a lot of propaganda, underhanded propaganda, kind of stirring that pot. We see it happen with Jesus. The same charges ultimately they brought against Jesus, they brought against Stephen. And so Stephen, the high priest, asks, "Are these things so?" Is the high priest, does he have any interest here in justice? As long as we're on that topic? No. He had no interest in justice. Okay? He found his way, we're gonna get this guy. We got the opportunity, the people are behind us, he's going down. And so Stephen's aware of that. He doesn't spend a bunch of time actually particularly. Let me put it this way. Years ago, when I was a a young guy, I always thought, you know, in the Lord's church, you deal with people and we're all regenerated, and so you can be completely honest and open and just put everything on the table, and no matter what the circumstances, situations are, and you just put the truth out there and it's going to all work out. I learned the hard way that's not always the case. There are times that there are people in the Lord's church who have an agenda. And if there's an agenda that's there, that truth really isn't the issue. It's a matter of how are we going to run through what we want run through. And so I had to learn some things. Jesus says, be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves. Hey, you have to be smart. You have to understand what's going on. Be aware of. Well, Stephen here is aware of where these guys are at. And so he's smart about the way he's going to build this case. He does answer the charge, and we're going to get to that. But along the way, what he is really doing is he is pointing out to these Jewish authorities that they're the ones who actually are being disobedient to the Old Testament law that pointed to Christ. And they're the ones he's going to pin the death of Jesus on their heads. So he has a plan where he's going. And so he starts with a history that they're very familiar with. And along the way, we see, you know, God calls Abraham out, and then Abraham, we got Jacob, and then we got Joseph. And what happened with Joseph? His own brothers mistreated him and sold him as a slave. Now God all along had a purpose though for Joseph. God's purpose for Joseph was to actually save this nation. And sure enough, the family of Jacob turned into that nation there in Egypt. And so that's where we kind of left off last time. Let's pick it up. Oh, let's do verse 17. Pick it up in Acts chapter 7, verse 17. I'm going to read through a pretty big stretch here about Moses. Let's do through verse 40. Let me ask you a question. Why do you think Stephen would dedicate a substantial portion of his message here to Moses? He's talking to Jews, number one. Establishing something about the law. What? Okay, so yeah, he starts with Abraham, their descendants. So two big guys, Abraham and Moses, right? He deals with both of them here. What's the charge against him? Going to alter the customs that were handed down to us by Moses, right? We're going to spend some time here with Moses and actually establish that Moses was leading up to the very one whom they're rejecting right now. That I'm just going to put it in these terms, Christianity is the fulfillment of that law of Moses. So let's pick it up, chapter 7, verse 17. But as the time of the promise was approaching, which God had assured to Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt until there arose another king over Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph. It was he who took shrewd advantage of our race and mistreated our fathers so that they would expose their infants and they would not survive. And it was at this time that Moses was born, and he was lovely in the sight of God. And he was nurtured 3 months in his father's home. And after he had been exposed, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. And Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds. But when he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. And on the following day, he appeared to them as they were fighting together, and he tried to reconcile them in peace, saying, "Men, you are brethren. Why do you injure one another?" But the one who was injuring his neighbor pushed them away, saying, "Who made you a ruler and judge over us? You do not mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday, do you?" And at this remark, Moses fled and became an alien in the land of Midian, where he became the father of 2 sons. And after 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai, in the flame of a burning thorn bush. And when Moses saw it, he began to marvel at the sight. And as he approached to look more closely, there came the voice of the Lord. "I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob." And Moses shook with fear and would not venture to look. But the Lord said to him, take off the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. I have certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt, and have heard their groans, and I have come down to deliver them. Come now, and I will send you to Egypt. This Moses, whom they disowned, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge, is the one whom God sent to be both a ruler and a deliverer, with the help of the angel who appeared to him in the thorn bush. This man led them out, performing wonders and signs in the land of Egypt, and in the Red Sea, and in the wilderness for 40 years. This is the Moses who said to the sons of Israel, God shall raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness, together with the angel who was speaking to him on Mount Sinai, and who was with our fathers, and he received living oracles to pass on to you. And our fathers were unwilling to be obedient to him, but repudiated him, and in their hearts turned back to Egypt, saying to Aaron, make for us gods who will go before us. For this Moses who led us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what happened to him. So as I said earlier, I'm not going through every verse of chapter 7. Okay? You guys know how long it's taken me to get through the first 6 chapters of the book of Acts. There's a lot of Old Testament history in here. It could be a years long process to get through chapter 7. So I'm just hitting the high points that a basic outline of points from chapter 7 that Don DeWelt had in his book Acts Made Actual. And so I'm just kind of following his outline, and then we'll springboard off of that a little bit. So the first thing we see is that, you know, Moses was born during the time that in Egypt it was all of the Jewish male babies were being put to death. Now, it's interesting when you read this account back there in the book of Exodus. It's a little tough to figure out where that time frame was, because Aaron seems to have been born and gotten okay. So, you know, somewhere you read about the midwives and the plan. And they're actually feared God a little bit and actually were letting these kids live. So it seems like maybe Aaron was in that time, and then they bumped it up. The Pharaoh bumped it up a notch here. And so with Moses, the time Moses is born, these babies are, male babies are being put to death. Now, just a little freebie here. Every tyrannical form of government does institute a culture of death. You can look at it a bunch of different ways. I do want to talk about abortion a little bit this morning in a moment. But you think about gun control. Well, let me just back this up. Why did Pharaoh here in Egypt, why did he want the Hebrew babies, the males, being put to death? Some of you new Christians remember why? Why was he interested in these? Casey, what do you got?
He didn't want his brothers would rise up against
them. So he's afraid if these guys are populating in Egypt, and he's afraid that the slave population is going to get too big and too strong and going to overrun them. And so, hey, let's put the males to death, right? Hey, let's finish these. Let's just keep these guys controllable. Why do tyrannical governments want gun control? Because the people that can arm themselves are dangerous. They might actually expect to have liberty. I remember, how did that t-shirt that Don Fletcher had? Democracy. I think it's a quote from Benjamin Franklin. I can't remember. It was one of the founding fathers of this country. But democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what they're having for dinner. And then I think the follow-up is liberty is one well-armed lamb contesting the vote. Okay? Yeah, that's I like it. Okay? But every tyrannical government, they want to keep people under control. Okay? And so there's a culture of death. There's a culture ultimately to destroy the will of the people. Okay? There's a You've seen that in this country too. Just bringing the population, the morality of the population down where people have nothing to stand on. And then make sure that they're not armed. Make sure that... let's keep the population under control. Hey, if we can get the people to be immoral in the first place, and then we allow them to have abortions, that sounds a lot better than telling them that we're going to kill a certain percentage of their children, right? It's not, now it doesn't have to be state mandated. It's just you have permission. It's acceptable.
It's interesting too that the two of the biggest proponents of population control are two of the wealthiest men in the country, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. It's clear that those it's not your average Joe, you know, that really pushes it. And they're just listening to the media, but it's those with the power and the money, and they want to keep the power and the money, and they know that again, it's just like Pharaoh, let's keep the little guys from rising up.
Yeah, and you know, the big names that we know like that, Bill Gates, for example. I mean, these guys, they are very wealthy, but you also don't keep your wealth and you don't keep your position in this country without playing games with the insiders, shall we say, the rulers behind the scenes. And these guys are great spokesmen for their cause. So that's a good point. So there's that agenda. But I want you to notice here a couple things about this. In verse 20 of Acts chapter 7, it was at this time that Moses was born, and he was lovely in the sight of God. I haven't said much on Facebook and that kind of stuff about abortion and even the homosexual thing, because I'm trying to figure out, it is very difficult to argue at the level, to argue at this point, because the people you're arguing with don't have the same foundation whatsoever. And so I think we have to back it up a little bit. I mean, I'm all for people taking a stand for righteousness and justice and putting out there, because I think anybody that watches those videos of Planned Parenthood and what they're doing with aborted babies and selling their body parts to make a profit, that ought to be, anybody that has a conscience, it ought to prick them pretty good. But you know, I was thinking about this. We're at the Peaks, and when we're getting ready to leave, the day we're leaving, Josh Eisenagel showed me, he had all these, like a handful, two handfuls of all these little tiny frogs. And he kept one, was going to bring one back and hope that he could get him to survive. I don't know how that turned out for him. But the rest of them, he just put them down. Well, he was a long ways away from the pond. And I was just like, huh, I wonder, my thought was, I wonder how many of those little frogs are going to make it back. But I wasn't particularly concerned. I had the thought go through my mind, but I wasn't particularly concerned. Oh, here, let me gather these up and make sure they all make it back and give them every opportunity for survival. I didn't really care, being honest with you. And it registered with me, this is a huge problem in our country. This is why we're at where we're at. Our evolutionary underpinnings, the foundation of our philosophy about life. If all we are, guys, is an animal, and the top animal, be it me, it's just survival of the fittest. And if it's just survival of the fittest, hey, if your parents choose to abort you, you obviously weren't one of the fittest. That's good. Let's keep that gene pool, you know. And they promote abortion for babies who have health defects, etc. Why do they do these, you know, ultrasounds at so many weeks so we can determine, oh, if your baby has some of these health defects, then you have a choice here to abort them before we go any further. What are they doing? They're just practicing the philosophy that virtually everyone holds to in this country. They're called secular humanism. It goes right along with with evolutionary thought. So the real important thing we have to determine is whether or not man has been made in the image of God. If that is a true statement, now human life has value. Now we can argue this point. It's clearly wrong. But otherwise, we're arguing about should the frogs be put back down in the lake, or are we going to let them die? That's what might going through my mind. Does that make sense to you guys? It seems to me that's really what we have to get to. And scripturally here, I love the way that this starts in Acts chapter 7. Moses was lovely in the sight of God. God made him. God had a purpose for his life. God cared about him. He was lovely to God. Now go over with me to Hebrews chapter 11. We could ask the question, is does every baby that's born, is every baby that's born lovely in the sight of God? Start that way. Jesus is pretty clear about that. I'm looking around the audience. I don't think we need to establish that children are in fellowship with God. But Hebrews chapter 11, I like this. In verse 23, it says, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents. Why? Because they saw he was a beautiful child. And they were not afraid of the king's edict. Moses, lovely in the sight. God had a plan for him. God had a purpose for him. In the time that he was born. And Moses' parents, they were faithful, weren't they? It's interesting, this section of Hebrews 11 is about the faith of Moses, but the faith of Moses starts with the faith of his parents. They saw what God knew. They saw he was a beautiful child. And I just want to work on us for just a second. Remember this. Raising kids can be a long process. And there are times I particularly feel for moms, because moms, you get the long, all the time, tugging at your pants, and mom, 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 push, 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 push. Let's say we can push mom over the edge today. We can run the house just for the day. If all we got to do is get mom to tilt over, you know. And so in the middle of that, sometimes we can, you call this a happy family? Why do we have to have so many kids anyways? I stole that from the movie It's a Wonderful Life. You can check that out. But, you know, that's a concept. That's an idea sometimes that can run through your mind. Hey, in the midst of that, remember, God has a plan. God sees your children as lovely. You see them as beautiful children. And hold to stay in there. Hang in there in the midst of, maybe it's, in this case, you're not having to stand up against the government authorities as far as whether or not you're going to put your child to death, but it is the same thing spiritually. Like, don't spank your kids. I don't know exactly where the legal crosses to illegal. I don't really care, other than you should be smart in the way that you do some things in public so you don't get turned in for things and your kids get taken away from you. These guys, Moses' parents, were smart about it, weren't they? They hid it. And then, but keep that in mind and follow through so that your kids can carry out the plan that God has for them. You get the picture and you remember that and you hold to that. Beautiful. Beautiful child. Hey, lovely in the sight of God. They recognized God had a plan for them, even though they didn't know exactly what that plan was and they didn't know how it was going to play out. We don't know either. But you got to know God has a plan. So, who can tell me the other side of this? In the Old Testament, we know that God is a jealous God, and He visits the iniquities to the third and fourth generations. But what's the other side of that? What's the follow-up to that? He keeps His loving kindness to what? Hear Mr. Simpson saying it. to thousands, right? He's talking about generations. Hey, you follow through. You open up Rother. There's a couple times in New American Standard, it'll tell you generations. Consistently, Rotherham tells you. This is God's plan is for this, on the good side, to go generation after generation after generation after generation of faithfulness. We, part of faith, brethren, as in for us, is to buy into God's plan and to say, yes, this next generation, okay, we are going to see they are lovely in the sight of God. We're going to view them as beautiful children, and we're going to raise them up and train them up so they can be the next generation who stands for the Lord. Hold on to that picture. We have a great example here of Moses and his family. I understand in the midst of trying circumstances, and I think it's going to get a whole lot tougher. Going to get a whole lot tougher. They're going to be much more mandated about, because, you know, the position of our country right now is your children aren't your children. They're wards of the state, and they get to live with you as long as you conform to what the state wants. I remember Todd and Charlotte, okay, with little JJ going to a meeting with you guys. And, you know, JJ has some very severe physical disabilities. And I went to a meeting, and it was unbelievable the things that you hear the doctors say and the whatever the government officials there. They have absolutely zero concept of JJ as a soul. Zero. And they made no bones about it. JJ did not belong to Todd and Charlotte. JJ is the state's, and they didn't think Todd and Charlotte were able to take care of him, which they probably did need some help. But instead of saying, hey, let's figure out how to help, oh, not your kid, we're taking him away, and it's a tough thing. And some of the comments that were made in there was absolutely, I can't repeat them here for Charlotte's sake, because it's just unbelievable. They have no concept. They're the philosophy of death really is rampant in our society, and the smartest, shall we say, among us, the most not the wisest, but the smartest, the most well educated, have bought into this the most. And so we gotta take stands against that and step up and follow the example of Moses' family. That second point that Moses was well educated in all the learning of the Egyptians. He became mighty in word and deed. He was a man mighty in word and deed. I find this, I love Acts chapter 7, because when God actually comes back and tells Moses, I want you to be the deliverer. This is 40 years later. Moses doesn't want to go. What are Moses' excuses? William Sweeney, what? Yeah, my tongue gets tied up in knots, right? I'm not good at this. I can't, you know. And God comes back with, "Hey, who made man's mouth?" Right? Hey, if I give you a message and I give you a mission, you can do this. But I find it interesting, Acts chapter 7, the recounting of the history. Moses was a man of power in words and deeds. That is an excuse. Hey, Moses didn't want to go, and I can understand a little bit why. Hey, after being so severely rejected by his brethren. But that's an excuse. And I'll just say this in passing on that. My dad, you know, I've shared with you guys how nervous I always was, and sometimes still am, to speak publicly. My dad always told me, he said, you have a message the whole world needs to hear. And that's true. Now, we have a message the whole world needs to hear. And if you care about that, it doesn't matter if you come in superiority of speech or of wisdom. What matters is the message that comes, that the world needs to hear. There's power there. And so, just a reminder, in case you try to let yourself off the hook sometimes, who made man's mouth? If the Lord has chosen you for a mission, oh yeah, He has. It's called go, right? If the Lord's chosen you for a mission, He's going to ensure that you have the ability to carry that out. He will be with you. So, Moses was a man of power in words and deeds. How many of you guys have read the book, The Exodus Case, by Leonard Mahler? JP has, Mike W., I know Kevin has, Stacy has. Excellent. I don't know that you could confirm every single, 100% nail down every single point that he makes in that book, but man, there is a trail of evidence that you can't miss, okay, about basically God bringing his people out of Egypt. Okay, is primarily what it deals with, that the story of the Exodus. But one of the things that he makes a case for in there historically, and documents some things that are, it's pretty compelling, is that Moses actually ruled as a co-regent for a time in Egypt. That he was actually being groomed to be the next Pharaoh. Now, I'll leave it up to you to check out the evidence and see what you think about that. But there is no doubt that Moses being raised in the courts of Pharaoh as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, according to Hebrews chapter 11, that and being well educated in the learning of the Egyptians, that he was a powerful man. Not just with his words, but if he said something was going to be done, it was going to be done. And so, at 40 years of age, he attempted to deliver his people from bondage, but he was rejected. I'll just back up. I want to say one other thing. There is something to be said for education, too. So, you can look at the big plan of God for Moses' life. Ultimately, for Moses to rescue the people and to deliver them from Pharaoh, was it going to be important that Moses understand the inner workings of that Egyptian system? He going to understand how it all worked inside the palace and how to be able to have an audience before Pharaoh? Because honestly, guys, isn't that sometimes a problem? It's like, how do we get an audience, a particular audience, to get something that's important done? Well, the Lord prepared this. And then, of course, as he wanders in the wilderness for 40 years, or while he's out there in the wilderness for 40 years, God's preparing him to lead the people as they wander in the wilderness for 40 years. God had a perfect plan. And there is something to be said about education. Moses was educated. So, you know, in reference to our children too, in terms of raising them up and giving them opportunities to carry out God's plan in their lives, let's follow through and understand it is important that our children be literate, that they can read and write, they're logical, that they can reason correctly. Those are all important things. And in many senses, we do need some, the Lord doesn't require everybody, but to do this, but man, there's some people, we need some well-educated young people who can stand up and debate with all of the wise naysayers of our day. So, all right, Mr. Simpson, while you were stepped outside, I just talked a little bit about Exodus Case. So, if you have any questions about that, I encourage you. Mr. Simpson's not just, I've read it, Mr. Simpson has poured over it. He knows that thing pretty inside and out, and it's definitely worth a read. I would really encourage you, and I know Mr. Simpson's kind of said that before. If anybody's interested, come see him about that. So, but at 40 years of age, Moses attempts to deliver his people from bondage, but he was rejected. And just as a side note from Moses' life for us, guys, sometimes our timing isn't God's. He can't get discouraged about that. There are times in my life I've had plans and I've had a focus, and I've, not just for me, but hey, for the congregation, and we're going to do this. You know, Larry talked about, you know, the things that we had kind of gone through right as we're building this expansion. And I was like, man, if I would have known these things were happening, maybe we would have held off a few years on doing this. My plans and my goals and my vision and my desire, and I don't mean selfishly, but I mean in terms of what I want even for carrying out the will of God, sometimes isn't the timing isn't the same as the Lord's. And you can't get discouraged by that. A lot of people quit. Moses ends up temporarily quitting, although God's still working on it. But I think it's important that we understand that. So but the main point here is Stephen is really ends up putting the Sanhedrin on trial. He's on trial, but not really. They are. And as he puts the Sanhedrin on trial, he brings into exhibit another rejection of the people of Israel against the one whom God had sent as the deliverer. You see what he's doing? He's building this case. Look, this is the history of your people. He starts with the patriarchs. These were the leaders of this nation, of this family, of this nation, and they rejected Joseph. Now, we got the people, the very people whom God sent to the... Moses didn't have to do this. He had no... He was not compelled whatsoever. But he looked and he cared about them and he reached out to rescue them. And what did they do? Reject him. Reject him. Did God have to rescue us? I mean, was God compelled to? Was he forced to? He had to because of his goodness. But he looked down and what did he do? He saw us, didn't he? Basically, like the people in Exodus, they are crying out and their cries were reaching up to God. How many of us, before we were in Christ, and we understand, I'm not talking about that God hears all of our prayers, but God does pay attention. His eyes are going to and fro throughout the whole earth looking for those. How many of us cried out to the Lord in our distress? How many of us were looking and wanted? God knew. God saw that from before the foundation of the world. And that's why He sent Jesus. That's why it was His plan. He wasn't forced to. But He did it for us. He's telling the Sanhedrin, hey, you guys, this nation, in trouble? God sending somebody? What do? Reject the very one whom He sent. So you can see He's laying the case in there. Now, some people connect all the dots. You know your Bible saying with people? And you're just putting I like to put the dots out there, right? And a lot of people, they'll connect these on their own. And those are my favorite studies. But not all of us always connect the dots. And there's various reasons for that sometimes that we don't. Many people, when they don't connect the dots, it's because they don't want to. But sometimes we just don't get something and, you know, well, that's a different story. But these guys, the dots are being laid out there. These guys are very familiar with Old Testament history and they're very intelligent people. You don't end up on the Sanhedrin without being plenty intelligent. But so Stephen's really smart about the way he's laying those dots in there. And then in the end, he's going to come back and he's going to make sure that those dots are all connected. But in there, guys, these guys are smart. And you see it with people who pretend like they aren't getting it, but they are. They're getting it. They're getting this message. You remember, this is the same people that Jesus tells parables about and they understood he was speaking about them. They get it. But Stephen's going to still drive it home at the end. All right. Moses killed an Egyptian in his zeal for God's people. He had to flee to Midian. Let's actually go to Hebrews chapter 11. I like the way that the New Testament recounts this for us. One thing I really like about Moses, I mean, he had it pretty comfy, guys. Possibly the next Pharaoh. Certainly, you know, there probably wasn't much he was lacking in terms of the comforts of that day. When the new chariot, he could have one, I'm sure. Whatever it was, Moses could pretty much get. And so when he made this choice and he saw... I mean, you can tell it was working on him. He saw his people being mistreated. And just working on him. So finally, he got to do something about it. God, I think every one of us in our life, there comes to a point. And there came a point in our lives where we said, you know what? There's one thing that's important and we got to do something about it. And I like the way that the Scripture recounts this here in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 24 through 26. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. Moses had a big choice to make, didn't he? Hey, one thing about it, you can't do both. I don't know how long this was working on Moses, but you can't do both. You can't. My dad says you choose heaven, you lose earth. A lot of people try to straddle this thing, keep one foot in both. Hey, you aren't going to get the best of either, just saying. But you won't make it. The faithful choose. Moses made a big choice. He chose to endure ill treatment with the people of God. Guys, ill treatment at that time was there, and he had to run for his life. Ill treatment is coming in this country. Much more severe ill treatment for the people of God. You got to be mentally prepared. When we made the good confession prior to our immersion, we said Jesus is Lord. We signed on the dotted line, and that's what we said. We made that choice, didn't we? Over the passing pleasures of sin, we made a choice. We are going to follow this through, and we counted the cost, and whatever it costs us in this life, we made that choice. Because we know, we're looking to the reward. Moses is a good example that way. And in my life, I'm just going to say this. In my life, the knowing what I know, and even knowing what I knew when I became a Christian, the big choices, guys, in my life haven't been particularly difficult. And you think about them, you make them, but in some ways it's really simple. You know the right thing to do. But it's sometimes those little day-to-day things that if you're not careful, they're not lining up with your big choices. So I want to encourage us. We make our big choice. We make our big sacrifices as Christians. We say, for the kingdom. And we, like I said, we signed our name on the dotted line. And we said, I'm willing to die for you, Christ. Yeah, Phil, do you remember what? Did you make a post on Facebook this morning? Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay.
Just tell us what that said.
Well, it said something to the effect of, I'll die for Christ is the confident proclamation of the one who's not willing to live for Christ.
Yeah, it's easy to kind of say that, isn't it? I'll die for Christ. Peter said it. I think he meant it. He made the big choice. He pulled the sword out, but it didn't work out the way he anticipated, and everything kind of went, he didn't have the right faith picture. So, we make this big choice, but I want to encourage us, guys, to make the little choices, too. Day in and day out. I saw a sign actually when I was in Red Lodge here, and I told Julie I wanted to take a picture of it, but it wasn't a good sign. It was outside of some bar, and it said some of the effect that hangovers only last a day, but drunken memories last a lifetime or something. I was like, this is interesting the way that they sell these things, isn't it? Yeah, hangovers last. There is always the morning after. And it's not just the morning, it's the month after and the year after. And it's where that leads, the death and destruction everywhere. But the devil isn't going to put it that way. He sells the look how pretty this is. Passing pleasures is true. The scripture says it. There are passing pleasures of sin, but they pass. And there is death and destruction that comes as a result. And we got to remember that. So we make our big choices. Let's make sure our day-to-day choices are lining up with that. Every day, picking up our cross and following. Every day, saying, I'm choosing the kingdom of the Lord over the kingdom of this world. Okay? So I like this example, again, of Moses. So Moses spends 40 years in the land of Midian, has two sons. God calls him through the burning bush to deliver the children of Israel. So, Moses, guys, it seems that he had given up on his role as deliverer. I don't know what... My guess is he had some nightmares about it over at that time. Just understanding me, knowing the way I operate. He might have had some recurring dreams from time to time, and he probably had to push them. Well, I did care about him, but they rejected me. I cared about him, but they rejected. I cared, you know, all that. The ways that we have of sometimes avoiding God's real purpose in our life. And in terms of making disciples, I want to put this out there too. There is going to be plenty of rejection. Just the truth of it. There are going to be a lot of people who either don't listen, or there are going to be people who obey and fall away. There are going to be people who take personal shots at you somewhere, and it's because of you that they quit. You know, whatever the case may be, you can't focus on that. You have to remember God's purpose and plan for your life. This is the will of God. And you keep moving forwards with that. Justin.
I think with that comment, it's worth bringing up. Because of the society we live in and everything is so right now, we got to have it. Oh, spent 20 seconds longer to get our burger than it should. Yeah, everything is so right now. To even see the examples like 40 years, like people say, oh, I'm 40 years old, I'm getting old. But look, 40 years old, Moses had just started this. Like, okay, God obviously had a plan, but if we can't keep him focused on the long picture, then those little decisions that we have to make to be able to get there, we're going to get those by the wayside because we lose hope.
Yeah, excellent. I'm glad you expounded upon that a little, because God's a patient God. And God is really, really a patient God. And we forget that sometimes. And we do want, you know I have a tendency to want stuff, you know, you guys can tell I've said that before. You call this fast food, you know. You pull into a place and you expect it to be fast because they advertise it's fast and it's not fast. And it's, come on. Sometimes we want that with, you know, our work for the Lord. Guys, who has a more vested interest in the Lord's work? The one who laid down his life for it, purchased it with his own blood? He's patient. A lot of years for the coming of Christ. That he built a lot of years with an obstinate people of Israel. And so, you know, I guess I just want to encourage us to take this and remember our timing isn't always God's. Isn't always the same as God's timing. Be patient. Keep the faith. Don't lose your focus. Don't lose your purpose. And I would also say this, don't focus on the people who reject this. A lot will. And if you live there, if you go there and you think about all the people who didn't make it and the people, why do I do this? All they don't even appreciate it anyways. And all they, you focus there, man, you'll never do anything. So you go after. We're looking for the treasure hidden in the field. We're looking for people who respond and do this. And you got to go through. You got to buy the whole field to get the treasure. That's the reality of it. And so don't let personal. I don't even want to say it that way. Samuel felt rejected by the people. And God said, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. You just got to remember that. And you got to keep moving forward. And you got to find that next soul who really wants to be delivered. Jesus is the deliverer. That's the point of Acts chapter 7. Because he uses us in this process. And there's a lot for us to learn too individually along the way. Thanks for your attention. And we'll pick her up next week.